and Ms. Baumgartner. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Plofchan, do you need any rebuttal time?
Your Honor, I would like 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Certainly.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Tom Plofchan, and I'm appearing on behalf of Jeffrey Brian Lee. Judge Beals, Judge McCullough, Judge O'Brien, thank you for taking the case and granting the writ. I think this presents some important legal and practice considerations for the court in this case. As noted by the court's granting of the writ, the issue actually in this case seems to be, and the briefs seem to be, I think, consumed by some of the procedural hurdles as to whether or not they were overcome. But the issue is whether the trial court denied Mr. Lee due process in failing to consider an act on his motion to withdraw a plea when he simultaneously filed a motion to stay the sentencing order and requested oral argument. And this was addressed in the appellant's brief and kind of not really glossed over or not really addressed by the Commonwealth, in that I don't think that there's really any issue that the one has a right to due process and one is supposed to have the right to have all the issues heard on their merits. And we, as we noted in our brief, 17.1-503B and 19.2-296 are statutory components that were put in place by the General Assembly to promote this nature of due process. As we also noted, Miranda told us many years ago that when constitutional rights are at place, rulemaking is insufficient to, and one cannot rely on rulemaking such that they would abrogate some of those rights. So what we actually are faced with, and based on the questions that were presented from the writ panel, is whether or not certain rules or the actions of trial counsel or the actions of post-trial counsel acted to waive or default certain arguments and such that the court was not required to hear the issues on the merits in this particular case. And I think it boils down to, in one general topic, we say, can a trial court, when a motion is filed, can a trial court not take action such that there is no ability to appeal or just not rule on it and without the violating due process? And the specific questions that the writ panel asked us to address kind of go to this issue of whether or not there is a procedural default on some of the issues. And they asked us to look specifically at Brandon v. Cox. And one of the issues, and Brandon v. Cox kind of raises the issue in two components. One is that whether or not the argument was actually presented to the court, and then the second, was there a contemporaneous objection or whether that there needed to be a contemporaneous objection in the case. And I think that it's interesting when we look at Brandon v. Cox, and obviously we have to take guidance from the Supreme Court of Virginia, and there is an interesting interplay between Justice Powell's opinion in the majority opinion and then Justice Mims' dissent. And one of the, in Justice Mims' dissent, he clearly indicates that there is a due process component in the idea of whether or not a court should rule on the merits in a particular area, finding that the rule therefore places, in this case he's interpreting 415D, the rule therefore places a special obligation upon the court to review such motions without prompting by the party, since it is otherwise unable to define whether a hearing is necessary, indicating that there is an obligation absent action by the parties themselves. What Justice Powell and the majority indicated was that they were talking about in that, in the Brandon v. Cox case, was that in that case there was no action, and I quote from them, beyond a mere filing in the clerk's office that the court had an opportunity to rule. Now, Justice Mims had taken the position that when one files something in the clerk's office,
I had always thought that was the case,
that you've made that position. Interestingly enough, and when we decide cases, we're presented with the facts of the particular case, and we have to make our decisions, and the court would make its decisions, and as a practicing attorney, we would rely on the court's decisions and our reading of the rules in terms of certain things. But Brannon v. Cox is distinguishable factually from Mr. Lee's case. Because even if the court, and we have to, this is the Supreme Court of Virginia, they've said what the opinion, majority has said what they've said, but they said that there was no effort to, beyond the mere filing in the clerk's office, to have something heard.
If we conclude, and we have the motion before us, to consider this affidavit, but generally, Virginia courts have taken a hard line on supplementing the record with factual matter. So if our conclusion is we can't consider that based on that practice, what does that do to this case?
I really don't think it does much, all right? And I'll tell you why. The affidavit, and we would argue that the affidavit, and we obviously responded, made our response to the affidavit, but the affidavit further supplements what could not be in the record in a particular case. And if there was an issue that we had to file something subsequent, that kind of goes counter to what this court had said, and as they quoted in the Amos opinion, and they cite in Vaughn v. Inc., that there's no obligation, no clear language that imposes any requirement that when an exception to the contemporaneous objection rule applies, one must take any post-conviction objection and so forth. But I started off saying, Judge McCullough, that I don't think it applies. And the reason I don't think it really or makes any significant difference is that in Brannon v. Cox, there was a motion that was filed. There's a difference between just filing a motion and not precipitating or asking any action to be taken. And if we look at 209 through 213 of the appendix, where the actual motion was filed and the precipice were filed, the precipice clearly directs the court to give it to the trial judge so that he can make a ruling on whether he will schedule a hearing. And then the motion specifically says, we would like to make oral argument on this behalf.
Well, can I ask you on that? Because a fair amount is made here of the fact that this in Loudoun County usually requests that something be placed on the docket.
Yes, sir.
And that was not done here.
Judge Beals, I don't think that that's a correct statement in where it is. I will say that, and I don't have all the learned knowledge of this panel. I do not have all the experience in the world, but I've been doing this for 23 years. And as I told the writ panel, there is no authority in my 23 years for me to place anything on the docket absent an order of the court. Right. Even motions they practice are pursuant to an order of the court.
Can you answer my question about whether it's important at this point when you're past the final order being entered, and it's been stayed until at least June 17th, to at least try to get the clerk to put it on the docket? And the way I read, since this was stayed until June 17th, you had 21 days after that till July 8th to actually get the court to hear it before it would lose jurisdiction.
What the court is really asking, based on the practice of the court, and we established, and I hope the court is well aware that we put in our two previous motions that were done without placing on the court, because that was the practice in Loudoun County. What the court is saying is, should a litigant or an attorney representing a party incur the potential risk of contempt by placing something on the docket, when the practice of the court is that post-trial motions are heard and scheduled at the discretion of the trial court. And if one says, oh, this is filed for the court to take action, and it's the discretion of the trial court whether they're going to hear or schedule, and they have an obligation to do that, if we ignore that discretion and say we're going to try to place it on the docket ourselves, I think that, one, it promotes, are we in contempt? And two, what is the vehicle for doing that? If post-trial motions and post-conviction motions...
How do you get the trial judge's attention so that under Brannon versus Cox, you've done more than just file it with the clerk's office?
Well, I think...
You can show that you've really tried to put it to the judge's attention.
You've hit the crux of the problem. When I began today, I said there are legal and practical consequences for this dilemma. Because if I can't place it on the docket, there's no vehicle for me to place the motion on the docket because it wasn't granted that they were going to hear the motion. What can I do outside calling the clerk, reminding them that we placed it? To the extent that we could, in a precipice, it was filed, asking the clerk to give it to the judge for consideration. Now, I would assume And that when one files that, one has to assume that the clerk is going to follow through with that request, and one would have to assume they do. If
let me ask the counsel, yes, excuse me. Is it fair to say that once you filed that, on the day that the order was going to go into effect, that the suspension was vacated or lifted, from the time after that, nothing else was filed, no other requests were filed, and as you said, you just assumed the judge had...
No, Judge, because what we had said, and what we had said in the affidavit is not only did we file it with the clerk, we sent a courtesy copy to Chambers, and then we subsequently called the judge's clerk asking if there was going to be a hearing on that, of which there was no reply. And so I think that we made efforts beyond mere filing it, but even in the context of the precipice, we didn't merely file it and leave it, which is what happened in Brandon v. Cox. They didn't even mention anything. We gave specific directions to the clerk. Now, that's an interesting play. If the judge says, I never received it, then that also, because it's connected with the judge, is that would be a due process violation, we would argue, from the clerk on forward, because what is a litigant supposed to do? I can't call a judge up and ask, you know, tell him to put something on the docket. There are processes in place, and so that's the practical concern that we have in this case. And when we look at 17.1 and 19.2, the two statutes I cited about the right to have something heard on the merits, I think that due process right has to be given some component. I think there is some responsibility on the court when that is made. I'm not saying it's a motion of reconsideration from reconsideration, because that's clearly governed under 4:15d, and that a court doesn't have to have a hearing, but it can, you know, rule or decide. But if the practice is post-trial motions, post-conviction motions are heard at the discretion of the trial court, then a trial court, when it's a new matter, such as to withdraw a plea in this case, it's not a reconsideration of a sentencing or anything else, it's a withdrawal of a plea, that's a new matter within the purview of the court that my client had a constitutional due process right to have heard in its entirety and on the merits. And I think
to get
that
a ruling, I mean, not necessarily oral argument, but at least something.
At least a ruling that would then preserve, so we say, no, I'm not going to do that, so that I could then preserve it on appeal and take it up forward to make an argument that was in violation in that context. And it's very important for this panel to understand that the relief we're not asking everything to be thrown out because of this due process violation. We're asking for saying that when it was filed with direction to the judge, the litigant, the attorneys could do nothing more. There wasn't anything in their power procedurally. Now, practically, they took steps in their power by delivering a courtesy copy to the court and so forth, but Judge McCullough said, what if we don't accept the affidavit? Well, procedurally, there's nothing more we can do. And when I look at Justice Powell's opinion in Brandon v. Cox, what it tells me is that I do something beyond the mere filing.
You're starting to get into your rebuttal time, and I just wanted to alert you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll stop at this point only because I think we've raised it in the brief and there were some points on, but I thank you for attention, and please, obviously, the attention of the Commonwealth.
Thank you.
Good morning. Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. Your Honors, the defendant's counsel just repeatedly argued, what more could we have done? What they could have done is followed the local rule. Loudoun County has one local rule, that when you file a motion, it has to include a precipice asking for it to be placed on the appropriate docket. They failed to do this.
What about the two prior motions that were heard by the court that weren't accompanied by this very precipice? Does that matter?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor. The fact that sometimes the court makes exceptions is...
It suggests a practice not uncommon in my experience of these post-trial, in the nature of a reconsideration, motions being treated differently from pre-trial and so on motions.
Even if on occasion the court did do that, the court's rule is clear, and they could have filed a proper precipice. And in fact, they filed proposed orders on at least one of the matters that did end up in the court. They didn't file any proposed order in this case. Similarly, in the motion to stay transfer, they filed a precipice. It was filed the same week. as the motion to for an extension to extend the stay and a motion, the motion to withdraw the plea. Same week, filed a proper precipice asking for it to be placed on the docket. This case, they didn't ask it to be placed on the docket. And
Governor, when do you think the trial court lost jurisdiction in this case? If you don't consider when the notice of appeal was filed, when would it have lost jurisdiction?
Well, I believe the current case law is that it doesn't lose, the notice of appeal does not divest the trial court of jurisdiction. So therefore, it was 21 days after the stay was lifted. The stay was lifted on June 21st, 2013, which means Rule 1:1 means jurisdiction expired on July 8th. They had 21 days. Even if this court considers the affidavit, nothing was done after the day the stay was lifted. Nothing. Not a single call, not any attempt. And in fact, when the defendant's counsel was in front of a court a week after that, with 2 weeks of jurisdiction left, they had the opportunity, is there anything else you'd like to say? And the response was not, hey, we have this outstanding motion and we can't get the court's attention. No one's ruling on this. It's, we filed a motion to withdraw and we're treating it as denied. They just chose to forego an attempt to get a ruling there. And just briefly, Your Honor, with the affidavit is not properly in this record. And I think one of the clear reasons why it's so inappropriate is because counsel
because counsel has an obligation to fashion a record, and could counsel have submitted an affidavit in the trial court rather than after that record is closed and then on appeal, saying the same thing? Would that have been proper?
Yes, counsel had two opportunities by which they could have gotten this on the record. One, they could have followed the rules for filing a supplemental statement of facts, which they did not. That would have had to go through both the prosecutor and the trial court. They did not do that. In addition, on June 28th, 2013, when in front of the court, counsel could have said, these are the
just something like what we have before us, just filing it with a trial court saying, I mean, we're talking about a member of the bar of the court just representing what efforts had been under. I'm trying to figure out how counsel can bridge this obligation under Brannon versus Cox, that it's not enough to just file, that you have to bring this to the attention of the court, when ethically you can't just pick up the phone, call the judge and say, hey, here's my ex parte phone call, please put this on the docket. So counsel's in a somewhat difficult position. I'm just trying to figure out how we can give guidance to the lawyers in this situation, how they can meet their obligation under Brannon versus Cox. I don't see why they couldn't just submit the affidavit. And, of course, the Commonwealth could object if they say, well, that's not factual or that's wrong.
Obviously, if they filed the affidavit, it would have been in the record that came up to this court.
Okay. Can I ask you, if we were to consider the affidavit, if we were to decide to do that, why isn't the fact that the copy was hand-delivered to the judge's chambers, to the law clerk, the trial judge, on June 17th, and then the affidavit notes several times prior to June 21st, there were phone calls made inquiring as to whether the judge had ruled. Why isn't that additional efforts to try to get a ruling by the trial judge here? Since, as Judge McCullough says, you can't just call up the judge and say, are you going to rule, or have you ruled yet, or when are you going to rule?
Well, Your Honor, I think the common practice is if you aren't getting ruling from the court, one, you make sure you follow the court's procedure, and two, you have the issue placed on the docket. The single local rule is clear that motions filed without a precipice will not be set for hearing and will not be forwarded to chambers for review.
Doesn't that, though, give you a practical problem with the 21 days after a final order? Because let's say you don't, for whatever reason, you don't get to file until the 19th day or the 20th day. And how do you get it? I mean, the case law is pretty clear. You're filing within the time you can, but it's close to the end. How at that point, because more than likely, even if you requested it be put on the docket, it's not going to make it on the docket before the 21st day ends.
Well, I do think that's a different case, Your Honor. And I think if that happens, there might be other issues. There might be other issues at play. There might be some sort of emergency.
There's a docket, I guess, every week at least.
I believe there was a regular Friday docket.
So that, I mean, in certain rural jurisdictions, you know, where the judge rides the circuit, you might not have it for several weeks in that jurisdiction again.
Correct.
But here, there is a practical way it could have been done is your argument, I guess.
There is a practical way it could have been done. And as this court decided in Richards, while it is an unpublished case, it is appropriate, even if a judge knows about the motion, if there are rules in place for it being properly placed in front of the judge can wait until the party abides by those rules. The party here did not make a true effort to get a ruling on this. I don't know if there was some confusion about when jurisdiction ended. I'm not really sure what happened, but the 21 days started running on the 21st, and there was no effort.
The 17th, right?
No, actually, I believe the 17th was the day the motion was filed, and the 21-day rule, the order was lifted on the 21st of June. Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. The 21st of June was the notice of appeal. Yes, the 17th was the day the sentencing order took effect, and also the day the defendant filed the motions. In addition, Your Honor, I think there's an important distinction to be made between the motion for to extend the stay and the motion to withdraw the plea, because ultimately we're talking about the motion to withdraw the plea and whether or not the court addressed that. The motion to withdraw the plea did not include any request for oral argument. There was nothing even within the body of the motion saying we want oral argument on this. That's one of the things that Mr. Lee's counsel has relied upon, is that the extension motion said in the body of the motion, we ask for argument. There's two problems with this. One, that no one gets there under the local rule because no one reads the motion if it hasn't been attached with a proper precipe. And second, the motion to withdraw included no request for oral argument, nor did it include any sort of proposed order. It simply, no ruling was actually sought in this matter. And this case really isn't distinguishable from Brandon there's no evidence in the record that the extension or withdrawal motion actually went to chambers. Once again, regarding the issue of whether or not counsel was required to object to the court's failure to rule, we would state it is for the reasons argued in the brief, and instead the motion was abandoned on June 28th when the court was told, we're treating this as a dismissal, we're appealing it. Essentially, they told the trial court, we have no interest in getting a ruling from you on this motion. And that's the opposite.
Well, but that doesn't seem to be a fair reading of what counsel said. Counsel said, we're assuming it's treated as denied because they hadn't, by that time, heard anything by the court. So it wasn't, we abandoned it, we have no interest in it. It was, we having not heard anything, we assume it's denied. Isn't that different?
I don't think it is. 10 days after a motion is filed, to say, well, we're just going to treat it as denied. The court case law is clear that you can't just choose to treat undecided motions as denied. There is a distinction between whether a court actually rules on it and whether it has been denied. In sum, Your Honors, while Mr. Lee is arguing that he did not receive due process, there was a procedure in place. He chose to ignore it multiple times. Accordingly, he didn't get the ruling. He didn't even object to that failure to get the ruling. And therefore, this issue is not preserved before this court. Are there any questions? Further questions? Thank you. I urge you to
look. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Plofchan, you have about 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Hoffman, can I ask?
Yes, sir.
That June 17th was when the stay was lifted. I assume you agree that you had till July 8th to try to get a ruling. Was there confusion about that at some point, given all the calls in what was done the 17th through the 21st, and then the notice of appeal was filed?
If I may explain, Judge, what happens is, contrary to the assumption you just made, there is not a weekly motions day in Loudoun County. There's 1 month, and it's usually, I think it's the third Friday of the month, and you have to give 7 days notice. When this was filed on the 17th, which was in time, the 7 days notice for the third Friday, it was with there, we couldn't have given 7 days notice to get it on a motion if even filed one, if we were had any idea that we were allowed to. As I said, the practice in Loudoun County, as evidenced by what we did before, was post-trial motions and post-conviction motions in that context, we're reviewing substantive issues, are scheduled at the discretion of the trial court. So there wasn't a confusion as to whether or not we could place it on the docket. There was an impossibility to put it on the docket under, you know, 1 week in advance, and B, that's not the practice for these kinds of things. It's a distinguishing thing between the second motion that was filed, and that's, I wanted to address that, I'm glad you raised it up, which was saying, can we get him to stay here while there's a pending appeal because we want him to assist with his appeal, and that was heard by a different circuit court judge. That's not a waiver of the underlying issues. That was a procedural issue that can be held by motion in this case, and what I would ask the court, what the Commonwealth is suggesting, is that the litigant, the attorney, is placed in a Simmons position. Simmons, I think it was United States v. Simmons, where the Commonwealth is saying you have to waive one constitutional right in order to preserve another. So in order to have effective assistance of counsel on appeal, we had to file a motion to extend the time, or not to have him stay here, to stay in Loudoun County so we could deal with him.
Circuit court judge.
He denied that, but we had to make that motion as effective assistance of counsel, his right under the Sixth Amendment. That doesn't mean that because we make that motion preserving his Sixth Amendment right, we're waiving his Fifth Amendment right to due process and have all the issues heard.
The question is, why, if you had until July the 8th, were all the activities so up at the front that there was nothing later on?
Your Honor, I don't think that it's a waiver, and I think that the issue that I came back to, and the only note I made on this, is the court is asking us as a litigant, without much guidance, how do we bridge Brandon v. Cox versus Vaughn? And Vaughn was cited in the Amos opinion. And in that case, they were talking about 801.384, which excuses the requirement for contemporary objection. And what they said was the plain language of the contemporary objection exception states when a litigant, through no fault of his own, is prevented from making a contemporaneous objection to the court's ruling, it shall not thereafter prejudice a litigant on appeal. The language is clear and unqualified. It imposes no requirement that when the contemporaneous objection applies, a party, if able, must file a post-conviction objection or otherwise bring the objection to the court's attention at a later point in the proceeding, as the Commonwealth argues. So this Vaughn, even though it's cited by Amos, which also cites Brandon v. Cox, Amos cites Brandon v. Cox, says that the mere suggests that the filing of the motion preserves the issue and there's no further requirement to follow on. Brandon v. Cox says the mere filing doesn't do it. The only way I can reconcile it is the practice of a regular, you know, just an attorney practicing, is that when you file, if you just file and say, clerk, please file this in the file and we're going to precipitate for action at a later time, that's insufficient. But what we did in the actual precipitate is we made a direction to the clerk to give it to the judge. I don't know what else to do procedurally and then practically ex law, outside the law, outside the procedure, we follow up with the phone calls, etc. And I'll tell the court, as a practicing attorney, I make one, two, maybe three calls to a circuit court judge and I'm not getting an answer. I have to go forward in you know, with regard to it, but what am I supposed to do? Again, incur the wrath of the court to the detriment of my client because I keep hounding him for an answer when I think we've done what we can do to bring it to the court's attention.
You're well past your 3-minute rebuttal time. Is there anything you want to say to bring us to a close?
I just wanted to emphasize again that as a practicing counsel and from Mr. Lee's benefit in this case, because he had an issue he wanted to have heard, this is a very important case, and I thank the court for considering it because we need some guidance on how to deal with that. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. We'll come down and greet counsel and take up the Moreno case.